From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide, and it's available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, with a remarkable ability to find offense and bias wherever they look, the political religious right hate group, Family Research Council, is trying to vomit Christian outrage at the venerable George Washington University. The reason why? A seminar titled Christian Privilege, But Our Founding Fathers Were All Christian, Right? Clearly, the multimillion-dollar FRC needs to keep feeding the profitable narrative of oppression, even as its leaders enjoy unprecedented access to the very highest levels of political, and in this day and age, that also means economic power. WWJD, indeed. Demanding that people of faith hew to a narrowly drawn set of dogmatic beliefs is nothing new in this country. The impact of that kind of orthodoxy can be devastating, and for faith leaders, it can cost them everything. Over the years, we've shared with you stories of the price paid by prominent figures who come to conclusions on marriage equality or inclusion of LGBT persons that had profound consequences for them, personally and professionally. For Bishop Carlton Pearson, a member of the Interfaith Alliance Board of Directors, it was the question of whether or not hell exists that led to the loss of his popular ministry. His story is told in a new documentary titled Come Sunday. It premieres on Netflix on Friday, but Interfaith Alliance is hosting a screening in our nation's capital on Thursday night. We'll link to all the details from stateofbelief.com. And finally, CIA Director Mike Pompeo is an intensely controversial pick for Secretary of State. While criticism doesn't stop with his well-documented and polarizing anti-Islamic views, that's certainly a part of it. On Monday morning, Interfaith Alliance is hosting a public briefing at the Russell Senate Office Building in Washington, D.C., titled Mike Pompeo's Anti-Muslim Rhetoric and Ties. In addition to Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline, those attending will hear from Arab American Institute Executive Director Maya Berry, Hoda Hawa of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, Catherine Osborne from Shoulder to Shoulder, and Scott Simpson of Muslim Advocates. Find information at stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
As an example, in San Bernardino, many people saw the bombs all over the apartment of the two people that killed 14 and wounded many, many people. Muslims have to report the problems when they see them. Because you look at Orlando, and you look at San Bernardino, and you look at the World Trade Center.
Go outside, you look at Paris. A new report from the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding titled Equal Treatment, Measuring the Legal and Media Responses to Ideologically Motivated Violence in the United States. I'll talk with Institute fellows Kumar Rao and Kerry Shinkman.
St. James Church has become a beacon of violence and controversy. And it has no place on Hadley University campus.
Alyssa Wilkinson writes on Vox.com that the Christian movie series God's Not Dead fails to be Christian. She'll be here to explain.
Hundreds of other protests are planned around the world on the same day. And we're told that each march is basically student-led. But did students really organize all of this in the 5 weeks since the Florida shooting? Let's look into who's really behind this.
This weekend, hundreds of gun policy town halls across the country are taking place, challenging lawmakers of both parties to take a stand on the issue. Town Hall for Our Lives was organized by student activists, the same ones who planned the nationwide student-led protest 2 weeks ago. At that time, I spoke with Will Salzberg about what he and his friends expected the march to be like, to see how it went and what they plan to do going forward. I'm pleased to welcome Will back to State of Belief Radio. Will, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.
So, what was it like to be part of the Washington, D.C. March for Our Lives?
It was incredible. It was powerful. It was a lot of emotions all at once. It was really well put together. All of the speakers were 18 and under, so they were high school seniors or younger. The performances were incredible. And in between each of those, there were different videos that talked about a lot of the issues that the teens have been bringing up with gun violence prevention, and they were very powerful.
Did you have a highlight of the day?
Yes, actually. My highlight of the day was when Martin Luther King Jr.'s granddaughter came on stage and shared a piece with everyone that was there, all 800,000 people. It was incredible. And I'm glad that she got to share in that moment with all of us.
Yeah. Will, was it your impression that a majority of the marchers were students and other young people?
You know, I think that it was about half and half. It was, I mean, more than you would normally see at a march, but also not like an overwhelming group. Like, it was a mix of everyone, which was really great.
Well, the reason, obviously, the reason I'm asking you is because opponents of change on gun safety have been relentlessly spreading propaganda that most of those attending the march were older or professional agitators or paid to be there or any other narrative that might reduce the awesome impact of the mass events 2 weeks ago. Of course, we've seen vicious attacks on the student leaders in this movement as well. Is that kind of propaganda even reaching those of you who are committed to this life-saving work?
So especially for the teens, like something that we've been pushing really hard throughout this entire movement is civic engagement, holding your representatives accountable for what's going on and their voting habits with gun violence prevention. So with that, teens are not the only part of the electorate. We need adults in partnership with the students to come together and agree that we're going to vote for candidates that support this kind of legislation. And that's not something like students can take the lead on that, but we can't be successful unless we have everyone on our side. So we're welcoming of adults, and to say that they're paid to be there, like, to me, that sounds like they're running out of excuses to show that they might be in the wrong and we're in the right. And yes, this is student led. Yes, there is a large group of students there, but we're not the only group in the electorate. There's adults, there's seniors, there's other groups of people that vote. And we need everyone's support in order to vote people out that won't support what we're supporting and vote people in that are going to make a change.
So, Will, are you saying that the internet troll culture that you all have grown up with kind of makes your generation immune to these kinds of attacks?
Immune, it might be a good way to put it. Immune, not totally, but we don't turn a blind eye to it. We definitely acknowledge it. And since we've grown up with it, which is a good way to put it, like, we know how to put it down. We know how to shove it to the side. We're not fazed by it.
Have you had any kickback in the community in which you live?
No, I haven't. And a big part of the reason why is we're talking about common sense gun legislation. We're not talking about repealing the Second Amendment. We're talking about making sure that we're regulating guns to a point where there's no senseless gun violence.
You have seen, I know, or read or heard some of the really terrible things that are being said about the ones of you that were out there in the streets as if it were all a fake event. What feelings well up in you when you hear the kind of criticism that's been offered toward the young people?
So just like with the trolls and the media that you were talking about earlier, I'm not fazed by it. The fact that we could bring out a group that was a little bit bigger than the Women's March, which I thought was like the pinnacle of huge marches, shows to me that whatever they have to say is probably going to be on the out of popular statements, and that like we are a force of nature and we are ready to make a change.
Are you staying in touch with some of the other people that you have met, whether they live close to you or far away?
Sure. Many of the people that I worked with in this endeavor, I have known on an acquaintance level and now have become more friendly with on a like a work level. Now we're really all, our brains are all shifting into what's next. So yes, we are still in contact. We're still talking. We're still meeting regularly, really around like what's next. What are we going to do? You talked about town halls. We also have a call-in day coming up on April 10th, next Tuesday. The march was a great, great beginning. The past month was leading up to a really powerful moment in DC and across the country. And now we're focused on what's next, which is town halls and that call-in day on April 10th.
In the conversations that you've had with your friends, does the attack stuff even get addressed, or you all are just going on with the movement and letting people say what they want to?
So we hear it, and like I said, we're really not fazed by it. We're dedicated to the issue of gun violence prevention in the United States. We want to see a change, and that's what we're here to do. Like, we've grown up with that kind of stuff flying around, and we're not going to step down. We're doing the work that we're doing, and we're persistent in that.
How involved are you with this weekend's town halls for our lives?
So I'm not that involved with this weekend's town halls. So a lot of the town halls happen locally, and I'm in Washington, so that is a little different. The only person that would have a town hall on the federal level is the DC representative, and they are not even a voting representative. So I'm not involved in that personally. But my whole organization is really behind getting people mobilized for April 10th, next Tuesday. We're having a call-in day to share with Congress our voices and that we're not backing down and we really want to see a change.
A big part of the way student activists have been able to organize so effectively is their expert use of social media. But I'm curious if being together in person has made a difference in the connections that you have made and the kind of feelings you have about what you're doing.
Sure. So my job or my role with Nifty is the vice president of membership. I enjoy being around people. I like connecting people. I like it when people make friends and find connections. So for me, the in-person piece is really powerful. Standing in front of 2,500 people a few weekends ago was incredibly powerful. And to be all together and to march together to the march was incredible. And then to stand there for 2 hours was incredible. So it's all incredibly powerful. And I think a part of it is being present together. So yes, the being together and the presentness is a beneficial piece of all of this.
Are there lessons that you've learned from the past few weeks that will help guide the direction Nifty activists take going forward?
Sure. It's to not think anything is impossible, to believe in your ideas, and just to be patient, be calm, and think through the kind of change that you want to see. Because as crazy as it may sound, as far-fetched as an idea it might be, any idea has the capability to get traction and to become change.
Will, what is this doing to you personally? When you sit alone for a moment and think about what's been going on, what's going on in your life?
Well, on another level, something that's been really incredible to be a part of and also watch is I'm a student and I'm not a professional. I like right after I'm done talking to you, I'll go to class for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I'll write a paper. But there are people who sit in offices all day who are professionals that do this work that are incredibly talented. Mm-hmm. So the work that we've been doing over the past month would not have been possible without them. And there are also teens leading it at the same time. So something that's been really powerful for me is getting to be in partnership with adults, for them getting to do the work that they're so good at and that they are professionals at, while I, as a student, am also able to lead the more ideological piece, the more we should be including someone here, we should do this piece here kind of role. So for me personally, it's been an incredible opportunity to work with adults, work with teens, and see all of that coming together.
We have listeners who want to know how they can follow your activism and how they can support this work that's being done. What would you tell them?
Great. I would tell them to visit our website, nifty.org/GBP. We'll give you our big page of everything that's going on with our gun violence prevention. GBP is the acronym for gun violence prevention. And our organization is Nifty, NFTY, so nfty.org/GBP. And if you're specifically looking for pieces of activism, you can go to nifty.org/GBP/act to find all of our stuff that we've been planning, especially around our call-in day on April 10th, our three A's for what's next: accountability, action, and allyship, making sure that we're partnering with different communities of faith and of race in our work, and acknowledging that this is an issue beyond what we're seeing in the news every day. So yeah, I would encourage those people to visit our website.
William Salzberg is membership vice president at NFTY, the Reformed Jewish Youth Movement. He's a college student and an articulate spokesman whom we intend to stay in contact with going forward. Thank you for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio, and get to class on time.
Thank you. Will do.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Alyssa Wilkinson writes on Vox.com that the Christian movie series God's Not Dead fails to be Christian. She'll be here to explain. And up next, equal treatment, measuring the legal and media responses to ideologically motivated violence in the United States. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Equal treatment, measuring the legal and media responses to ideological motivated violence in the United States. That's the title of a brand new report just released by the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, and I am pleased to welcome Institute fellows Kumar Rao and Carrie Schenkman to State of Belief Radio. Welcome, friends.
Thank you for having us.
Did the research back up what we tend to assume, that there is a clear double standard in this country?
Yes, I think that is exactly what our report confirms. You know, we went into the report process not making any assumptions or making any prejudgments mm-hmm. on what we were looking for mm-hmm. and what our conclusions might be, but ultimately, you know, really examining whether and how, if so, perpetrators or suspects of ideologically motivated violence may be treated differently by the media and by our legal systems. And ultimately, what we found answered that question, that in fact, yes, as an example, what gets charged as terrorism by federal law enforcement, what gets covered in the nation's most influential papers appears to depend heavily on whether a perpetrator is perceived to be Muslim. Mm-hmm.
How were you able to quantify the reality that we're talking about? What are the hard numbers that you found?
So we used a lot of hard numbers, both in the media and in the courts and from law enforcement. So in the media, we looked at thousands of news articles, and we looked at questions like how many articles were written about an act or plot of violence, how many times was the word terrorism used, how many times was somebody's religion referenced, was religion referenced at all or in headlines. On the legal side, we looked at the corresponding court documents for the violent plots and looked at charging documents. We looked at the sentencing documents. So we looked at those legal records and looked specifically how long were the prison sentences, what crimes were being charged. And that's how we were really able to quantify the differences in cases where to the average person, the acts or the violent plots, we specifically looked at violent plots in the name of an ideology, they didn't look too different from one another. We had cases involving plots to use assault rifles, plots to use bombs. We had many well-known cases of mass violence and also many cases that are not well-known, probably for the reasons that we found in our report, that they just really weren't being covered.
Tell us about some of the hard numbers.
So a few of our headline figures were that, as on the whole, people who were committing or plotting violent acts who were perceived to be Muslim were facing more severe legal charges, longer prison sentences, and significantly more media coverage. So on average, when it came to violent plots, Muslim perceived perpetrators were getting four times the average sentence of their non-Muslim counterparts. And in terms of print media coverage, Muslim perceived perpetrators received at least twice the amount of media coverage and up to 7.5 times as much media coverage. So there's really a staggering difference, both in terms of the legal sentences and also the sheer quantity of coverage.
Let's stay with the media coverage for a moment and talk some more about how the inequity of reporting or coverage you found in media itself.
Sure. And, you know, I would definitely encourage your listeners to take a look at our report. We've listed out, you know, dozens of findings and graphs, which are, I think, people find very interesting. I'll give you a few examples of some of the more compelling ones. As an example, as it related to the plots, meaning where perpetrators or suspects were either thwarted or stopped before they were able to actually complete their act. In terms of just overall coverage, those suspects that were perceived to be Muslim actually received an average of 770% more media than others accused of plots of really similar magnitude. On average, on the numbers we looked at, you know, it was anywhere from 7 to 8 approximately on the articles per perpetrator on the Muslim side versus just one on the non-Muslim side. And for the particularly, you know, on the maximum end in terms of like the really big, big pieces, it was 24 articles that were written about a Muslim perpetrator and just 6 on the other end. So that's just sort of an example of the quantity of coverage. When it comes to language framing across all our different kind of subcategories, we saw that the media uses the word terror or terrorist in reference to perceived Muslim perpetrators significantly more often than others. So on the plot side, again, 77% of articles that reference Muslim perpetrators use that word in some way. There was such little coverage of non-Muslim plots that we weren't even able to examine how much the word was used. But across the other categories, it really was in a small minority of cases, despite the fact that we were talking about incidents that involved bombs or assault rifles or even incidents that resulted in the deaths of, you know, many people, whether it was in Charleston when perpetrated by Dylan Roof or in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, where a, you know, neo-Nazi gunman murdered several Sikh worshippers inside of their religious institution.
Media double standards are bad enough, but law enforcement bias certainly is even worse. So would you talk about that side of the report's findings?
Gladly. So we not only notice a
huge disparity in the media side, but also on the legal side.
Mm-hmm.
The perceived Muslim perpetrators of violent plots were charged with more severe crimes significantly more often. So when I say more severe crimes, these are crimes like terrorism or possessing or using weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. And very, very heavy offenses that carry huge penalties that it's possible that go to prison for decades for. Mm. And in contrast, the suspects who were perceived to be non-Muslim were charged with less severe crimes, the vast majority of the time. And those less severe crimes were things like possessing a firearm or possessing an explosive. And usually that meant 5 or fewer years in prison, not 20-plus years in prison. So these differences in charging really made a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someone might ask, well, were the crimes worse on one end? Was that severe treatment deserved? And the data we found showed, no, it really wasn't. Because we compared many factors on how severe these violent plots were.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at how many plots for the perceived Muslim and non-Muslim involved assault rifles, bomb plots, car bombs, whether the targets were government, civilians, government buildings. And across all these factors, the two categories that we looked at were really similar.
Hmm.
So it really turned out to be an apples to apples type of comparison.
Yep.
And when I say that there were more severe legal charges too, that meant real things in terms of the prison time that suspects were getting. So the prison sentences were actually approximately 4 times as long for the Muslim perceived perpetrators.
Hmm. So what in your work gives us a place to start in figuring out ways to reduce this kind of thing taking place?
At our core, findings and outcome that we're seeking really is a reflection of the name of our report. So our hope and expectation would be that equal conduct would receive equal treatment, mm-hmm. both in the media and in our legal systems. And so coming from that framework, I think we are eager to see ideas and policies that could help make that more of a reality.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're also cautious, though, about some of the reflexive proposals that sometimes get, thrown out when people hear about these kinds of disparities. As an example of that is a domestic terrorism statute. Because right now, our legal regime is set up such that people, perpetrators of violence, can be prosecuted under a terrorism statute only if they have a link to a foreign militant organization and not a domestic one. And so, many of the perpetrators that we examine on our non-Muslim data set didn't have necessarily a foreign element. It was very much a domestic group. It didn't mean they were not associated with a militant organization. It didn't mean they were, not planning with others in this country. But ultimately, there is no legal statute to prosecute them for that conduct. There's been proposals suggested to do that and to remedy that, but I think we see that as potentially dangerous for civil liberties. And even from a racial justice, social justice perspective, we know that when government begins to develop new prosecutorial functions and resources, that it almost inevitably falls back on marginalized communities. And in this case, I think it's likely we might end up seeing much of the same problems being reinforced.
I have two more questions, and I want to ask, these are not directly about this report, but certainly relate to the Muslim experience today. First question is, Interfaith Alliance is deeply concerned about the Islamophobia that lurks in the history of Secretary of State nominee Mike Pompeo. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I don't think we would probably comment on that given the scope of our report, but I think we are certainly believe that our report and findings, we would hope, can be used to raise attention to structural Islamophobia in our country and in our legal and media systems, and again, challenge both of those entities to do better.
Right. And finally, this past week, there was a lot of concern in the UK about a so-called Punish a Muslim Day that was promoted online by far-right figures. In the United States, New York City was on high alert out of concern about this hateful messaging. Other cities were as well. How concerned do we need to be, all of us, about this kind of rhetoric in our civic bloodstream?
Well, I saw a response to that call, that so-called Punish a Muslim Day, and there's some responses that actually satirize that. It's saying that it's 364 days fewer than normal. And I think even though that's clearly intended to be satirical, I think there's kind of an element of truth to that, in the sense that these are systemic issues. And I think in doing our report, we don't seek to minimize threats of violence. But I think the end point that we get at, actually, is that we're not calling for an increase in domestic terrorism prosecutions or more sensational media coverage. What really matters is equal treatment for equal conduct. And the bottom line is that if we're talking about safety, especially safety in our communities, I mean, the policy choices and misallocations of resources that lead to these biases end up making it so that we're not drawing media attention to some of these very scary cases where people are plotting very serious acts or devoting law enforcement resources to that. So really what the data shows is that right now it's lopsided, and it really shouldn't be for many, many reasons.
Kumar Rao and Kerry Shinkman are fellows at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. The Institute's new report titled Equal Treatment, Measuring the Legal and Media Responses to Ideologically Motivated Violence in the United States. It's available online, and we will link to it from stateofbelief.com. Gentlemen, thanks for the work that you did on this, and thank you both for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
It's a growing force in our politics and our culture. Christian themes, specifically evangelical, religious right themes, are driving public policy and, at times, entertainment as well. A few years ago, a film titled God's Not Dead seemed to defiantly challenge not only Nietzsche, but brought in over $60 million doing it. There have been now two sequels, and writing about this franchise on Vox.com is Alyssa Wilkinson. The headline is, Why the Christian Movie Series God's Not Dead Fails to Be Christian. And I'm happy to welcome her to State of Belief Radio. Alyssa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're coming to this film from a similar place as I am, a person of faith with a lifetime of familiarity with American evangelical Christian culture. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in a conservative evangelical home, and I have spent a lot of my career working in that world. I teach at a Christian college, and I've worked for Christianity Today.
So how does that knowledge impact the themes that you identify in this film series?
I think a lot of what I bring to the film series is having sort of watched them through the lens of knowing what people are talking about in the film. So there's a lot of references in them to sort of ideas or people or books or just kind of concepts that have floated around, I think, in the world of conservative evangelicals for a long time. And they're really brought out in the films. They're made to sort of constitute the story. So I think the largest one of these is the perception of persecution and the perception that that conservative evangelicals are the most persecuted people in America, which the statistics bears out. This is actually something that people say and that they think. And in fact, research shows that white conservative evangelicals believe that they are more persecuted than African-Americans or Muslims or Jews in America. And that's kind of a long-running thing that's had a long history in popular culture, and especially in the way that evangelicals perceive themselves, whether it is through songs and books and movies or whether it's through, you know, the media that, that often will consume things like Fox News or talk radio, things like that. So I think having kind of knowledge of that context makes it a little easier to understand where these films are coming from, what part of the culture they are, how they're part of a continuum, and what they mean to the people who are watching them and why they're so popular.
You know, it really is about a permanent state of feeling persecuted, even while politically dominating the country right now. Do you see this as more of a tactic or a genuine sense of grievance, no matter how misplaced it may be?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things going on. I mean, one is that we can't rule out the fact that there are people who stand to benefit from this, from creating this persecution kind of complex. I think that you can see that a lot in media, particularly media outlets that try to kind of pump up the fear of other people, maybe unfamiliar people, immigrants, those sorts of things. You know, this is a long, long history in America. We've always been kind of afraid of people who don't look like us or worship like us, despite, you know, what we say about ourselves and what we want to believe. But I think that, you know, some people stand to profit, and so the sensational stories are the ones that get promoted. I think for a lot of people, though, it's really just this kind of perception that's out there, and then there are some things that seem to indicate it might be true, like maybe you feel like your beliefs aren't accepted where you work, or you feel like they're under assault, you know, in local politics or something like that. And so that feeds into this perception that everything is always getting worse, and that things, you know, bad things are on the way. We also have to remember that pop culture has been promoting this within the evangelical world for decades. So a really strong example of this would be the Left Behind books, which were massive, massive, massive blockbuster hits when they came out in the late 90s and around the turn of the millennium. And they tell these stories of future tribulation that will come to people based on sort of a certain interpretation of the book of Revelation. And these books were a hit partly because they're kind of thrilling reads, but also because they, you know, feel like maybe we're reading stories that are related to what's going on today. This is how evangelicals have often interacted with stories of, you know, future persecution. And there's also the sense that people around the world are being genuinely persecuted for their faith, that people are being jailed and, you know, harmed and not allowed to be able to participate in societies in different countries. And I think, you know, some people want to sort of participate in that and want to support people of, you know, of their own religion, fellow Christians who are experiencing persecution, often from governments that are hostile to their faith. But they sometimes, I think, then try to map that back onto their own lives here in America and not really see the position of privilege that they're living from. And, you know, it's perhaps hard, if that's your mindset, to see that Jews and Muslims actually are facing persecution in some ways that cause them to fear for their lives, like in America, and that Black Christians have dealt with these things a lot more maybe than white, you know, evangelicals in sort of comfortable suburban places have been dealing with them.
How can this film and others like it help people who are not familiar with this culture better understand the grievance mentality that seems to drive everything it does?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. There is a way in which watching these films is like revealing of what people are worried about and perhaps even what they, you know, what drives them towards this persecution mentality. So each of the films has sort of a set of villains, or at least of people who are antagonists, that map pretty neatly onto a lot of the rhetoric you might hear today. So, for instance, the kind of villain of the first film is an atheist philosophy professor who doesn't really resemble any philosophy professor that most people have bumped into, but he's this caricature of a villain who argues with a freshman about the existence of God, and he's a militant atheist. And so that's a thing that people are concerned about, or that sort of see as something that actually exists out there. Or there's a journalist who is antagonistic towards people of any religion. There's several other kinds of characters like that. There's a ACLU lawyer in the second movie who is like, I'm going to prove that God is dead, and says these sorts of things that I think for a lot of people do sound pretty laughable, but, you know, in many ways they're kind of characters written to fit a mold that already exists, perhaps in the minds of many in the audience. And so I think that watching them can be really helpful in understanding what kinds of characters populate that culture as antagonists, and to understand that, you know, maybe the best way to talk to friends and family who might be inclined to think this way is to really kind of lovingly show how those caricatures aren't in fact accurate or honest, and they often hurt more than they help, especially for people who at the end of the day really do want to learn how to love their neighbor. So I think the movies are revealing in that way. At the same time, I think they're completely noxious and you know, really pretty cynical about what it means to be a Christian in America. And so I find them difficult to watch. But I think if someone can stomach them, they're pretty useful for kind of understanding that world.
Who makes these films?
There's a main company that makes these particular movies, PureFlix, built on the back of God's Not Dead. So the first movie was extremely successful. It made like $60 million at the box office on a $2 million budget. And so they kind of went from being just a production company to an end-to-end production and distribution company. They make movies, they distribute them, they have their own streaming service that people can subscribe to that is like a stand-in for Netflix. And, you know, they're trying to hit a target market that has very particular preferences. They prefer movies with no objectionable content at all. Maybe a little violence, but certainly no profanity or, you know, drugs or nudity or sexual content of any kind. And also that prefers movies that are uplifting or inspiring in some way, that really bolster the spirits and beliefs of the people who watch them. And that's their target market. You know, these aren't like cynical Hollywood executives capitalizing on people or something like that. It's just happens to be huge business. It does very well with its target market. And I think that some of the movies are made with evangelism in mind. I don't think that they're very successful at that. But I think the bigger goal of these companies and of these movies is to give people an entertainment or alternative that fits their preferences and that also will prop up their own beliefs that already exist.
When you look at the intersection of conservative Christianity and popular culture in our country, what concerns you most?
I think what I'm most worried about is the way that the popular culture created by that part of the subculture is so insular, and it's so kind of impervious to anything outside of itself. It's very interested in answering life's questions, but it doesn't seem to me, and I think to a lot of other people, like they ask the questions very honestly and that they give people space to kind of grapple with those questions. So they always kind of wrap up with a bow at the end. And I think the tendency has been for a long time for conservative evangelicals who want to make art to think that it's basically utilitarian. Whether it's good or not depends on the message. I think what I've seen is that people are much angrier and more fearful than they used to be. There's a kind of fear and anger that it's almost difficult to comprehend how pervasive it is and how much it drives the way people talk about not just people who they perceive as their opposition, but also just, you know, people that are whole classes of occupations, journalists and lawyers and
politicians and people who you might hear on the radio is just, you know, they can't be good if they have that job. So I think that's been really discouraging to see in the context of a religion that's not supposed to be about that at all. That's, you know, expressly the opposite, that's led by someone who hung out with tax collectors and, you know, the most hated of society. So that's been really discouraging. But I will say, on the flip side, I teach college students. I talk with a lot of young people. I'm still on the younger end myself. And what I see is that a lot of younger people, they're not as steeped in the kind of polarized, particularly like cable news media, maybe that their parents and grandparents are. And they're also really, really interested in how other people think and why, and even in trying to have conversations and also not to take pat answers. And so I hear interesting things that they say and that they think and ways that they think of to solve problems that, you know, older people maybe are just convinced are always going to be problems. So I don't think particularly evangelicals are going to look anything like they do now in 20 years. I don't know whether that means that the movement is about to implode or if it means that the movement is about to evolve in a big way. I'm not sure, but it's a young movement itself, and it certainly has a lot of room to grow and change. And so I guess that's what I'm hoping that we'll see in the future, is that younger people will, you know, step up to the challenge.
Alyssa Wilkinson is Vox's film critic. Her work has appeared at Rolling Stone, The Washington Post, Christianity Today, and many others. She teaches criticism and cultural theory at the King's College. Alyssa Wilkinson's Vox.com article is headlined, "Why the Christian Movie Series God's Not Dead Fails to Be Christian," and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Alyssa, it's great to talk with you, and thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric way too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We want you engaged in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. We'll be coming to you from Atlanta, Georgia, with my very special guest, former President Jimmy Carter. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.